Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
With the announcements of the ceasefire between Iran and the United States, the ongoing military activity in Lebanon poses a grave risk to the ceasefire and efforts towards a lasting and comprehensive peace in the region.
As the U.S. and Iran prepare to hold ceasefire talks in Pakistan, Israel's continuing to bomb Lebanon. The death toll from its massive attack on Wednesday has topped 300. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then, to Trump's threats to pull the U.S. out of NATO. After European allies refused to use military force against Iran to keep the Strait of Hormuz open.
But I just want to tell you, NATO treated us very badly, and you have to remember, because they'll be treating us badly again if we ever need them, and hopefully we're never going to need them. I don't think we will need them. I don't think they can do very much.
Then voters in Hungary head to the polls Sunday. Could it mark the end of Viktor Orban's rule? On Tuesday, Vice President J.D. Vance went to Hungary to campaign with Orban, a far-right nationalist who has led Hungary for 16 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military's continuing attacks on Lebanon, threatening to derail a fragile two-week ceasefire agreement ahead of high-stakes talks between the U.S. and Iran in Islamabad this weekend. The death toll from Israel's massive strikes across Lebanon Wednesday has topped 300. More than 1,150 people have been injured. The Financial Times described Israel's attack as, quote, one of the deadliest single bombing campaigns in the history of a country racked by decades of war and destruction, unquote. Israel and the U.S. have claimed the Iran ceasefire deal does not include Lebanon, but numerous other nations disagree. The U.S. is expected to host talks between Israel and Lebanon next week in Washington. After headlines, we'll go to Beirut to speak with the award-winning journalist Rania Abuzaid. Iranian officials have warned the United States not to allow Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to derail the two-week regional ceasefire by continuing attacks on Lebanon. On Thursday, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, wrote on social media, quote, if the U.S. wishes to crater its economy by letting Netanyahu kill diplomacy, that would ultimately be its choice. We think that would be dumb, but are prepared for it, unquote. Araghchi's language mirrors language used by Vice President J.D. Vance, warning Iran not to let the ceasefire fall apart over Lebanon. Vance is heading to Pakistan today for high-level talks with Iran and Islamabad. He'll join U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, who previously held negotiations with Iran that were derailed twice when the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran. House Republicans have rejected an effort by Democrats to force a vote on resolution to limit President Trump's ability to wage war in Iran. On Thursday, with most of Congress still on recess, Maryland Democratic Congressmember Glenn Ivey rose to speak during a pro forma session where he asked to pass an Iran War Powers resolution by unanimous consent. But Republican Speaker pro tempore Chris Smith quickly gaveled the session to a close without allowing Ivey to speak.
Pursuant to Clause 13 of Rule 1, the House stands adjourned until 2:30 p.m. on Monday, April 13th, 2026.
Congressmember Ivey and other House Democrats gathered on the Capitol steps after their attempt to force a vote on a war powers resolution was pushed off until at least next week. This is Pennsylvania Congresswoman Madeline Dean.
over the weekend, we read and heard the president's Easter morning tweet of profanity, blasphemy, danger, and the following day his threat to eliminate an entire civilization. Pause there. These are not normal times, America. When will my Republican colleagues stand up in the House, in the Senate, the Vice President, the Cabinet secretaries who surround this madman? When will they grow a spine? When will they say, stop?
Israel's cabinet has secretly approved the establishment of 34 new settlements in the occupied West Bank, Israel's largest ever recognition of unauthorized outposts in a single step. The cabinet made the decision on April 1st, but it was classified until Thursday when an Israeli military censor approved it for publication. This comes amidst a sharp rise in Israeli settler violence against Palestinians. On Wednesday, 28-year-old Ala Khaled Sabi was shot and killed as armed Israeli settlers attacked the village of Tayasir, east of Tubas. Separately, 65-year-old Palestinian farmer Hussam Abdel Latif Wadan says he narrowly escaped a mob that descended on his farm.
Yesterday they attacked us. I was on my way to open the water irrigation system and they attacked me, around 12 settlers. I escaped, thank God. They were very close to me, only around 10 meters away.
The UN reports over 1,070 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem by Israeli forces or settlers since October 2023. In the Gaza Strip, health officials say Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 9-year-old girl in front of her third-grade class Thursday, traumatizing students and teachers who were left in psychological shock. Ritaj Rahan was reportedly struck by a bullet without warning as she was sitting at her desk in a tent serving as a classroom in Beit Lahia. Video and photos show her bloodied body being rushed through the streets toward a hospital on foot since there was no medical transport available in the area. She was one of four Palestinians killed by Israeli attacks across Gaza on Thursday. Mourners also gathered for the funeral of the Al Jazeera journalist Mohammed Washa, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike on his car Wednesday. Al Jazeera reports Israel's attack Gaza on 36 out of the past 40 days, despite a U.S.-brokered ceasefire that was supposed to have taken effect 6 months ago. A federal judge has rebuked the Department of Defense for defying his earlier ruling requiring the Pentagon to restore access to credentialed journalists. U.S. District Judge Paul Friedman ruled Thursday Trump administration officials had committed a blatant attempt to circumvent a lawful order, unquote, after they failed to comply with his March 20th ruling voiding large sections of a highly restrictive press policy introduced by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, which violated the First Amendment. In October, dozens of reporters turned in their government-issued press badges rather than agree to the rules, which state that news outlets cannot obtain any information that the Pentagon does not explicitly authorize. Thursday's ruling reinstates the press credentials of seven New York Times reporters and applies to other members of the Pentagon Press Association. A federal judge in Washington, D.C., has postponed the termination of temporary protected status, TPS, for about 5,000 Ethiopian immigrants living in the U.S. after determining the Trump administration likely disregarded the rules Congress set up for the TPS program. Wednesday's ruling comes as the Supreme Court is poised to hear oral arguments later this month on challenges to the Trump administration's attempts to cancel protected status for over 350,000 Haitians and 6,000 Syrians. The United Nations Migration Agency warns over 180 people are feared dead or missing in the latest shipwrecks in the Mediterranean, including more than 80 migrants who went missing when their boat capsized Sunday after departing from Libya. The International Organization for Migration reports nearly 1,000 people have died attempting to cross the Mediterranean into Europe since January, one of the deadliest starts to a year since record-keeping began. First Lady Melania Trump unexpectedly summoned reporters to the White House Thursday, where she read from a prepared statement denying any relationship with the late serial sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
I have never had any knowledge of Epstein's abuse of his victims. I was never involved in any capacity. I was not a participant, was never on Epstein's plane, and never visited his private island.
Melania Trump also acknowledged she'd exchanged emails with Epstein's accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell, in 2002, but dismissed it as a casual correspondence. A document from the Justice Department's incomplete release of the Epstein files shows Maxwell referred to Melania in an email as Sweet Pea, to which Melania replied, "Give me a call when you're back in New York." The letter concluded, "Love, Melania." Melania Trump infamously appears in a 2000 photo posing alongside her husband and ex Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Meanwhile, the First Lady is calling on Congress to hold a public hearing specifically centered around Epstein survivors. In response, the ranking Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, Robert Garcia, said he agreed, urging Republican Committee Chair James Comer to schedule hearings immediately. The First Lady's comments reportedly caught White House officials off guard, including President Trump, who told an MS Now reporter he had no prior knowledge of what his wife was preparing to say. The acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has blocked the publication of research showing COVID vaccines were highly effective at preventing hospitalizations for healthy adults last winter. The Washington Post reports the findings had cleared the CDC's scientific review process and were scheduled for publication March 19th in the agency's flagship scientific journal before acting director Jay Bhattacharya personally intervened to withhold the report. In 2020, Bhattacharya was a main author of the Great Barrington Declaration, which argued against COVID lockdowns at a time when no vaccines were available. Argentina's Congress has approved legislation that rolls back protections for thousands of glaciers, making it easier for large-scale mining projects to move forward. The reforms are supported by Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei. Environmentalists warn the legislation threatens critical freshwater reserves that are the source of drinking water for about 7 million people. On Thursday, protesters rallied outside the National Congress building in Buenos Aires.
I would tell the lawmakers that they were elected to represent the interests of the people, not those of the big mining companies or big capital, and that they should rise to the occasion because today they may get the deal that they want, but this affects all of us. Tomorrow, they too will suffer the consequences of not having water.
Hundreds of doctors, nurses, and public health workers have signed an open letter demanding the removal of Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin. They warn Zeldin is, quote, pursuing a deregulatory agenda that will result in a massive increase in health-damaging air pollution, toxic chemicals, and climate-heating greenhouse gases, unquote. On Wednesday, Zeldin delivered a keynote address to a gathering of the Heartland Institute, a right-wing think tank that promotes climate misinformation. Zeldin celebrated his decision to revoke the 2009 endangerment finding, which allowed the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, and praised the Trump administration's rollback of fuel efficiency standards for new cars and trucks.
Manufacturers should make whatever the American consumer wants, rather than what politicians and bureaucrats demand. This morning and today, all of you gathered here in D.C., is a moment to celebrate. It is a day to celebrate vindication.
Zeldin's comments came as NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, confirmed last month was the hottest March on record for the contiguous United States, with temperatures more than 9 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. The finding comes as forecasters warn a strong El Nino is likely to exacerbate global heating from human activity, which could make this year surpass 2024 as the hottest year on record. Sources say Zeldin is being rumored to be under consideration to replace Pam Bondi as attorney general. And Chinese President Xi Jinping has met with the chair of Taiwan's main opposition party in a landmark meeting, the first of its kind in a decade. Speaking from the Great Hall of the People in Beijing, President Xi declared China will absolutely not tolerate independence for Taiwan and called for the island's reunification with the People's Republic of China. Cheng Li-wen, who leads Taiwan's KMT party, replied that the Taiwan Strait should no longer be a flashpoint for a potential conflict and warned against external interference, an apparent reference to U.S. and Japanese support for Taiwan. Cheng has called her six-day visit to mainland China a journey of peace. It comes as Taiwan's opposition-controlled parliament has stalled a proposed $40 billion increase in military spending. This is Cheng Li-wen.
What should be flying in the sky are birds, not missiles, and what should be swimming in the sea are fish, not warships. Human technology should be used to seek well-being for humanity and for the earth. Human technology should not be for mutual slaughter or for the destruction of ecosystems.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. and Iran prepare to hold ceasefire talks in Pakistan, Israel's continuing to bomb Lebanon. The death toll from Israel's massive attack Wednesday has topped 300. More than 1,150 people were injured. In a span of 10 minutes Wednesday, Israel struck 100 sites across Beirut, the Bekaa Valley, and southern Lebanon. The Financial Times described Israel's attack on Lebanon as, quote, one of the deadliest single bombing campaigns in the history of a country racked by decades of war and destruction, unquote. Israel and the U.S. have claimed the Iran ceasefire deal does not include Lebanon, but numerous other nations disagree. Earlier today, foreign ministers of Pakistan and France condemned what they called serious ceasefire violations made in Lebanon, unquote. CBS News reports Trump initially agreed Lebanon was included in the ceasefire, but his position changed after a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. is expected to host talks between Israel and Lebanon next week. As Israel continues to attack Lebanon, Hezbollah has retaliated by firing missiles at Israel. At the United Nations, a spokesperson for the Secretary General spoke Thursday.
With the announcements of the ceasefire between Iran and the United States, the ongoing military activity in Lebanon poses a grave risk to the ceasefire and efforts towards a lasting and comprehensive peace in the region.
Since the war began in late February, Israel's killed more than 1,530 people in Lebanon, including at least 130 children. In Beirut, grieving families gathered at hospitals to identify bodies after Israel's attacks on Wednesday.
I had dropped off my sister. She went up into the house. I went on a little trip and they hid. I came back and didn't find the building. I didn't find my sister and I didn't find my family, any of them. I found my brother and his son was in the rubble.
We go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Rania Abu-Zeid. She's an award-winning Lebanese-Australian journalist, author based in Beirut. Her books include No Turning Back, Life, Loss, and Hope in Wartime Syria. Her latest piece in New York Magazine, just out Thursday, headlined The Iran War Is Not Over, Scenes from a Day of Carnage in Beirut. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Rania. Why don't you describe those scenes of a day of carnage in Beirut? We have a four-second delay, so we will wait.
It was 10 minutes of terror, a day that the Lebanese are calling Black Wednesday. It was hard to tell what was blowing up where, because those 100 or so attacks were all happening simultaneously, and not just in the capital, Beirut, but also in other parts of the country. They targeted very densely populated parts of the capital, neighborhoods in the capital, that were themselves hosting people who had been displaced from other parts of the country. In the Bekaa, mourners at a funeral in a cemetery were targeted. In Beirut, workers at a well-known roastery were removed by civil defense personnel as charred corpses. So it was a very, very ugly day. And as we speak, I can't say rescue because there's Unfortunately, the people are dead, but search teams continue to try and locate and find and retrieve the remains of people who were killed in the rubble of their homes.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, said Israel will, quote, continue to strike Hezbollah wherever required, but later said he's approved direct talks with Lebanon as soon as possible. Can you talk about what's happening with these negotiations? You had the Belgian foreign minister who'd come into Beirut to meet with the Lebanese president, Ayoun, and the bombing hit very close to their quarters as he was congratulating the Lebanese president on saying that he would directly negotiate with Israel, then condemned the attack and said Lebanon had to be included with the ceasefire. Can you take it from there? What's happening now? Where do you understand these talks will take place?
Well, the first thing is that the talks remove Lebanon from the wider ceasefire talks that are due to take place between Iran and America tomorrow. That has many Lebanese worried because they wonder what sort of leverage does Lebanon have. It doesn't exactly have a Strait of Hormuz, whereas Iran seems to have a stronger negotiating position. Yesterday, Lebanon's Prime Minister Nawaf Salam made it quite clear. He said that Lebanon, the Lebanese government, will negotiate for Lebanon and that nobody else will do so. So he's very clearly drawn the line between whatever Iran negotiates and what he hopes his government will be able to negotiate with the Israelis. Now, the Iranian foreign minister has made a ceasefire in Lebanon a condition of tomorrow's talk. So it's unclear whether or not they are going to go ahead. So in addition to the question of what sort of leverage does Lebanon have, some Lebanese are also worried because there is a precedent. There is a 15-month so-called ceasefire where this is the second war in less than 2 years, and there was a 15-month ceasefire between the two. During that period, the Lebanese government was supposed to negotiate indirectly with Israel through something called a mechanism, which was U.S. and French-led, to ensure that each side fulfilled its requirements under the terms of that ceasefire. During those 15 months, Israel continued to occupy five hilltop positions that it had newly seized in the war. It was supposed to withdraw from them under the ceasefire. It didn't. It was supposed to withdraw its troops back across its border under the ceasefire. It didn't. So the Lebanese government was unable to get Israel to adhere to any of the conditions of the ceasefire. So some Lebanese wonder what it will be able to achieve now. In addition, I have to say that just the mere fact of direct talks not only breaks a taboo here in Lebanon, it also breaks a very long-standing law. Since the mid-1950s here, it is considered an act of treason to have any direct interaction with an Israeli. But the Lebanese president himself, General Joseph Aoun, about a month ago, called for direct talks with Israel, breaking that massive, massive taboo. He had four conditions for these talks that were supposed to be followed sequentially. The first condition was an immediate and complete ceasefire. Condition number two was that the Lebanese army is strengthened. Third was that the Lebanese army would continue its efforts to disarm Hezbollah. And then fourth was the direct negotiation. So it looks like the Lebanese state has jumped over the president's own, three of his conditions to go straight to the fourth one. So Hezbollah, for its part, has said it does not think that Lebanon should be negotiating under fire because it puts it in the weaker position. Some Lebanese fear that this is a ploy by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prolong the war under the pretext of, having these talks under fire. The proponents of the talks, I have to say that it is an issue of Lebanese sovereignty, that Lebanon will negotiate any sort of deal with the Israelis. They also say that Lebanon is not a card for the Iranians to wield or to use in any negotiations. And they point out that, well, you don't exactly talk to your friends to make deals. You talk to your enemies. So it's a very, very divisive issue. The Hezbollah Secretary General is due to give a speech later this afternoon where he will no doubt address the issue of the talks. And there's supposed to be a protest here in Lebanon, just behind me, actually, in front of the Grand Sarai, which is where the Prime Minister's office is, against the idea of these talks.
Let me turn to the questions you raise in your latest New York Magazine piece, The Iran War Is Not Over, Scenes from a Day of Carnage in Beirut. First of all, how much of Lebanon is Israel prepared to destroy while claiming to target Hezbollah and its infrastructure? And will the world just watch as it does so? And your second question, can Israel even defeat Hezbollah militarily? Or is it, as many Lebanese suspect, trying to exact so painful a price from fellow Lebanese that they turn on the group, plunging the country into civil strife? Take on into civil strife, those two.
Well, the Israelis have made no secret of what they want to do in Lebanon. Officials from the defense minister, Smotrich, the finance minister, they've all talked about Lebanon being part of their greater Israel project. They have talked about seizing and occupying southern Lebanese territory up to the Litani River, which at its deepest is about 30 kilometers away from the Israeli border. Israel Katz, Israel's defense minister, said that he wants to turn that area, that lush, verdant agricultural area, into a wasteland that resembles what the Israelis did in Gaza. He has threatened that the hundreds of thousands of Lebanese who have been displaced from there will not be allowed to return. So that's what the Israelis have indicated that they want to do. In terms of what they're able to do, they have, according to Israeli media reports, had to scale back some of those ambitions because of the fierce resistance that they're facing on the ground from Hezbollah fighters. Let me give you the example of a town in southern Lebanon called Khiam, where there are Israeli forces in this town, but they have been fighting for weeks and weeks to try and take control of it, and they have been unable to. So according to the Israeli media reports, they now say that they want to occupy about a 3 to 4 kilometer strip of territory. And Hezbollah will no doubt fight and try and prevent them from doing that, too. So that's what the Israelis want to do. In terms of Lebanese turning on each other, Israeli officials called up. There are a couple of Christian villages down in the south. There are also Sunni. There are Druze, as well as the Shiite villages down south. It's a mixed area. And the Israeli officials called up some of those Christian towns where the people refused to leave their territory, and told them, listen, do not shelter your Shiite neighbors, otherwise you will come under attack. So that's a very clear sort of indication of what the Israelis are sort of hoping to foment in terms of civil strife and turning literally neighbor against neighbor.
Let me play a clip from a Beirut resident, Naeem Shebo, survived a bombing Wednesday, said he's now afraid to sleep. He said he wants the fighting to stop and blamed Hezbollah.
We want peace. We don't want problems with anyone anymore. 80% of Arab countries have peace with Israel. Why doesn't Lebanon have peace so that we can end all these problems? As long as Hezbollah is in Lebanon, Israel will strike Lebanon. That's it. Hezbollah is not defending Lebanon. It's defending Iran's agenda. That's it.
Rania Abu Zaid, how common or typical is this comment of a Lebanese who survived the bombing on Wednesday, Israel's bombing?
The Lebanese are very divided over the issue of Hezbollah and its weapons, and they always have been, but more so now in this recent war, because it started on March 2, and Hezbollah lobbed about 6 rockets into Israel, claiming that it was in retaliation for the assassination of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, as well as, quote, in defense of Lebanon. So many Lebanese saw it as a war of choice almost by Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah and its supporters say that after those 15 months of a ceasefire that wasn't really a ceasefire, because according to the UN, Israel violated Lebanon's sovereignty about 15,000 times during that period, There were thousands of attacks resulting in the deaths of more than 350 Lebanese. So Hezbollah's supporters say they were patient for those 15 months and now they have chosen to respond. But certainly there are Lebanese who are very angry with Hezbollah. They don't want any war. I mean, no Lebanese wants war. Even the hundreds of thousands of displaced, many of whom might be Hezbollah supporters, everybody wants to go home. You know, war is not the option.